Welcome to the Science of Psychotherapy podcast with your hosts, Richard Hill and Matthew Darlitz.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Science of Psychotherapy podcast. My name is Matthew Darlitz. I'm Editor-in-Chief of the Science of Psychotherapy. And as always, I'm here with Richard Hill, our amazing Managing Editor. Howdy, Richard.
Look, I'm fantastic, and that's not what you asked me. You didn't ask me how I was. Rude.
How are you?
Well, g'day. I'll answer the first question second and the second question first.
Well, you look all right. I'm assuming you're okay.
Yep, no, going really well. We're starting to warm up here in Oz, good old Oz, the US, you're starting to cool down. And Europe, well, we just don't know what they're doing. It's just confusing over there.
They're in between.
Although, but it's wonderful to be here. Wonderful to talk. Now, we had an interesting mastermind, and this sudden opportunity arose, and that's what today is all about.
Absolutely. So we just decided to turn on the recorder and record this for our podcast. So we are talking to two amazing people that have joined us on our mastermind. And the first is Mitra Rashidian, and she is a licensed marriage family therapist, certified sexologist in private practice at Encino in California. And she has a stack of credentials. I won't go through them all, but she is a very clever woman. And she is joined with partner Robert Jaffe, and he is also incredibly clever in the area of hypnotherapy, in drug addiction recovery, and he's in full-time practice, and they have radio shows. And again, he's got a whole lot of academics behind him as well, which I won't read out. But these are two very interesting people. So we thought, wow, we must record this conversation for you all.
Yes, and it turned out to be a beautifully succinct and erudite conversation about the natures of addiction, the relationship issue, but the relationship of those addiction issues, the sexual problems, attachment. I've so much enjoyed it, and I'm so glad we're going to put it out and share it with everybody, and hopefully it's a bit of an inspiration for our members to come and join the mastermind. There is so much knowledge sitting around in a single room.
It is really fun sitting around in a round table chatting about all of this stuff. So, Richard, let's go across to our mastermind.
Let's go.
We just had a podcast, which we have it every week at KMET 1490. That's ABC News Radio. Okay. And we on Thursdays, we talk about relationships, intimacy, love, and human sexuality, different aspects of human sexuality and sexual healthcare, and how those impact a person's life and ultimately impacts relationships.
Is this a talk show?
That's a podcast. ABC News Radio, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And on Fridays, we have another radio show on the same channel, 1490 KMET in California. We do a radio show and also a podcast, and the topics on that have to do with codependency and addictions, and not just chemical addictions, but process addictions such as sex and gambling. You could put actually food in either one of the process or a chemical addiction. The purpose of all addictions, of course, is to give you relief from internal angst, internal discomfort, and also to create a feeling of euphoria so that you feel like you're floating and you're not fully present. And the only reason that people want that is because they're not inside feeling a lot of joy and a lot of connection and a lot of love. So if you're feeling that, you don't want to check out.
Right.
And because they talk a lot about there's other things a little in the sense that addiction is a reaction to lack of relationship.
Yes.
Which is certainly implied in, you said that quite successfully there. But that sense, I wonder if you could just address that in relation to intimacy and Mitra, because this is wonderful, the balance that you two bring to the discussion. Mm-hmm. Is the degree to which when you get in that out of it stage, you achieve a false euphoria, how that makes the person feel as though they are then in some kind of relationship. Is it? Are they having a relationship with the euphoria, or what is it? What are your thoughts? I mean, that always is fascinating. It's a question I've always wanted to ask somebody. So there you go.
Yeah, well, people ultimately, they want to feel good. And then some people, you know, they feel good through addictions because they look for that ultimate relief, even if it is for a moment, right? So anything that gives them that joy and sense of relief from the internal pain and suffering that they have, they go for that. So, and some of them, they actually find relationships that not only it's abusive, but at the same time, just the connection itself is gives them the sense of safety and comfort.
Yeah,
so this cycle continues. So, but ultimately, all addictions are about not wanting to take a look at the pain and looking for an easy way out of the pain, which is, you know, we call it addiction, and denying what's what the problem is and how to get to the root cause of the problem. And so, but, you know, codependency actually is a type of relationship that feeds both sides, just like your, you know, your daughter has says that in her book. And that by itself is an addictive relationship. It's a form of addiction to stay in an abusive relationship in the name of love, in the name of taking care of, in the name of controlling each other. In the name of many, many contributing factors that keeps the relationship going. Mm-hmm. And addiction, you know, is a part of it. And not just, you know, substance, but addictions comes, you know, in the process form, which is more common in relationships than substance kind of addiction. Am I correct?
I don't know if it's more common, but certainly.
But more common in terms of not being noticed as an addiction.
Oh, I see. People do not recognize that they are in a codependent relationship, that there's an addictive quality to it.
Right.
I was a supervisor at an addictions recovery center for 24 years. And so I led groups and I did supervision for the staff. And what I learned was that I'm not going to say 100% because I don't like the all or nothing philosophy about things. But I experienced people going through recovery as having experienced either abuse, abandonment, or neglect in their early years, and sometimes all three, sometimes two of the three. But all of those lead to a feeling of disconnection and alienation because you're not seen and appreciated and loved for your authentic true self.
Mm, yeah. So this is...
So you're hungry for that.
Yeah. And when we talk to Dr. Oliver Morgan, you know, he definitely draws this this straight line between addiction and attachment disorder. So addiction is an attachment disorder.
Yes, I think so.
And you know, one of the major abuse that contributes to this situation in adulthood is sexual abuse.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Sexual abuse, and it doesn't. I'm not talking just about rape, but any kind of a unwanted touch, you know, in childhood can manifest itself in you know, a form of number one, unhealthy attachment, and also ultimately in one form or more than one form of addictions in adulthood. And codependency to a degree, I would say, is going to be a part of that. The childhood experiences has a lot to do with people going for addictions and staying with that. The stage of denial is such a easy way out for people to take a look at their internal pain, and addiction does that. Addiction, you know, takes people to a place of comfort, to a place of that they feel safe, even
safe.
If it's for
safety
and strength
for a very limited time, and then safety and sense of power, And unfortunately, that, you know, becomes deeper and deeper and deeper if nothing is done for it.
So what addiction does is it gives people a sense of relief, but it doesn't give them any sense of release.
Yeah.
So they get relief from the negative feeling states that they're in. They get that euphoria, which gives them relief.
Yeah.
But then because it doesn't feed them what they really are looking for, which, of course, is love and a feeling of safety and connection, it wears off. And then they have to continue with the addiction to get that. And then the body becomes acclimated to it. And so they have to then need more and more of whatever they're addicted to.
You know, one thing that you mentioned about attachment, and I'm very much in favor of that myself, and Robert too. People usually believe that, you know, unhealthy attachment happens among family members, that they are not educated or they are at a lower socioeconomical status, where in fact we see severe addictions, you know, of any kind, you know, among very sophisticated, high scale, you know, high class people, according to society, right? And the reason is that that attachment that we're looking for, that healthy, positive attachment that we're looking for, doesn't happen. And it, because it's about childhood. Many parents, especially rich parents, they think by giving their children everything, you know, they're giving them love. By everything, I'm talking about
material,
you know, things, money, material, expensive vacation, expensive, whatever they give them. And then they are absent themselves as parents.
Mm-hmm. And, I mean, Robin Williams is probably a famous example of that, that he there was all that. And he certainly went into a highly addictive behaviors with substances, but he addicted himself to comedy. He became constantly sought entertainment and fun and making the funny thing and talking to the people. Interesting.
So all that and all those nannies, no matter how caring they are, they don't they're not a substitute for parental love. Mm-hmm. And that's why we see that rate of addictions at the extent that we see among, you know, people that we think they have everything in their lives.
Mm-hmm.
But we see very healthy children growing up in the families that they don't have much to live with. But, you know, an example of that, for example, if you look at women of, let's say, Sri Lanka, right? Their children are attached on their back, like a backpack. And they do, you know, they work in the rice field, they pick up rice, they do all those work, right? And those have actually some of the most healthy and happy children in a set of people who work outside and they have nannies to take care of their children.
Right.
So the amount of connection that, you know, parents have, in particular mom, with their children during childhood, it's such a, you know, fundamental aspect of, I mean, I don't want to say it to this extent, but honestly, that's what I see, that addiction, having a child going for addiction or not, has a lot to do with the level of healthy attachment that they develop with their parents.
There's an interesting, I'm just seeing all these little lights flashing up, because I did a lot of work in and do a lot of work in suicidal behaviors. Mm-hmm. And so I'm hearing Schneidman, who's famous in that area, talking about psych ache, and that a lot of the reasons why people suicide is because they just can't stand the ache, the pain, which we're talking there, and the safety and comfort. And then the work of, was it Moshe and Ziff, where they were looking actually at a genetic thing, but what they did was they found they were able to go back and look at suicide victims, and certainly what they found is if they had this particular genetic disposition and they had insecure attachment issues, that was very, very bad. Now, here's an interesting question that may be too much to ask, but, you know, is addiction something on the pathway to something as dangerous as suicide, or are they perhaps do they branch out, or is it a bit of both? I mean, when we're working with addicted people, what areas do we need to protect them from?
Yeah, I have seen addictive people when I used to work at psych hospitals that they actually did attempt suicide or actually committed suicide.
So they were sort of on a spectrum.
Right. I have seen people of that they had addictions and they did attempt, but they really didn't want to die.
Right.
But they felt like, they had no choice. But when we did therapy on them afterwards and everything, they said they didn't want to die, but they wanted the pain to go away. So that's the common phrase that I used to hear from those patients. And then there are some that they believe addiction, nothing's going to happen to them, and they can stop anytime they want to.
And that's more of a branching where they make
that's more of a branching.
This other part.
Yeah, and some they don't even believe that they have an addiction. Like I have couples here that. They use, substance. They drink. They use marijuana. They use coke, but they just absolutely don't want to believe that they have an addiction, and they think they join it recreationally because their friends do it. They just want to have fun, but for some reason it increases each time.
They're doing it every day and don't stop.
Right, and they don't want to believe that they have an addiction. So we see all kinds of it. Yes.
Yeah. Can I ask, so in mainstream medicine, because addiction, if we talk drug addiction, say opiates, and we're chemically shackled to the drug, and typically, historically, then the answer has been a chemical answer. So we've got to deal with, the drug addiction with maybe a methadone program or something like that. How are you seeing, is the field changing in terms of looking at this in terms of attachment, or are we still in mainstream medicine, still looking at purely at a chemical level?
When you say mainstream medicine, are you referring then to how doctors would treat addiction, like how local doctors?
Yeah. So the majority of the population will go to a medical facility to get help.
Right, right, right. And I think generally speaking. You're looking at behavioral changes. Mm-hmm. Most addictions recovery centers are about changing the behavior.
Yeah,
and that's what they focus on. And it does work for some people. Doesn't work for a lot of people. A lot of people, you have the revolving door, and they're in and out a lot.
Right, because modulating behavior is very different to meeting an attachment need.
Correct, correct. And also, for the most part, a lot of the people who are running these centers are not psychologists. Right. So they're not aware that that's important, and so they don't have the treatment for it, and they also don't have follow-up. Where the person can get the kind of emotional help that they need.
And this is the challenge, isn't it, to make
to educate people. Because I think, for me, society is still, I always say, we're living in a world where we are technological giants and emotional morons, And that accounts for why Trump, can be even in contention. Now that we've seen what he does, he's still in contention. Yeah. And because people emotionally, they don't get really what's going on.
Mm. And yet those things that you brought up before with addictions and with these various incoherent sort of behaviours, safety and comfort, that sense of this makes me feel safe. And I think also investing yourself in an action, in an idea. I mean, to some extent, we might even be able to, it's slightly different, I know, than a substance, because that takes on another frame, but where you become addicted to just being successful, for example, you go
right.
Addicted to business, addicted to some of these other frames, in that you've invested so much in it that mm-hmm. you let it go would be damaging. They're interesting. Mm-hmm.
Right, and the injury is right brain injury, because it is about attachment, and right. So people often retreat into left brain. And left brain, we can accomplish a lot, of course, and so you can be in your work, and you're not having to attend to the feelings. You're simply in work mode.
That's interesting. Mm. That's interesting, Matt. Yeah,
yeah, it is. And I'm just remembering in talking about this, Sharif in Egypt, you know, with his program, and saying the most salient aspect of the program in terms of dealing with addiction was. Attachment was connection, was family, and that sense of being in a family, in a tribe.
Yeah, they used to have barbecues, didn't they? Regular sort of out on the balcony of the institute.
Yes. Yeah. And so, you know, they're set up as a, you know, medical facility, and mm-hmm. you know, Sharif has access, you know, can. Do different things like a methadone program or whatever, but that's not what is making the difference. What's making the difference is just gathering them around and inviting them into a family.
Yeah. And unfortunately for a lot of people, family is a dirty word.
Right.
You know? Yeah. So, yeah. And it's very sad. And also, you know, again, I think the majority of people have no idea that their childhood has any impact on them at all. And I think people who struggle with addictions and codependency are also in that category where they have no idea, you know. And if you try to talk to them about that, they're very resistant to it. And there are a few people who want to take a look at that, but they're still in the minority. And it's not societally condoned or approved of. We still live in a society that where a lot of people think that hitting the child is okay.
Yeah. But I was also thinking, Mitra, that sexual disorientation and insecure sexual sense, it's not so much attachment, that comes from that early abuse.
Well, yes, I mean, it comes, you know, it depends on, you know, if you take a look at Erik Erikson's psychosocial, you know, developmental stage, or if you look at, you know, Freud or Piaget, we can see that how messages that a child collects from his or her environment since birth. And actually now I see in some articles that they are looking at prenatal exposure to those messages. So why mm-hmm. the child is still is in, you know, growing up in utero. Yes.
Yeah.
We see that, you know, the sense of anxiety, the sense of depression, the sense of stress, the sense of even fear, you know, is with the child. So, and then when a child is born, and depending on how the mom is providing care to the child and how present she actually is. And by presence, I'm not just talking to be there and to feed the child, but actually I'm talking about maintaining eye contact, maintaining, you know, skin contact, maintaining a safe holding environment. And that's really by far such a vital concept that, you know, I think it requires in-depth training to all the new moms so that they can understand what is that safe holding environment for a child actually means.
You need more training to drive a car than to become a parent.
Right.
Yes. There was one thing that Susie was looking at recently where they just, because she does pediatric stuff in her nursing, and they just took this particular group of women, and they had a similar cultural background, and just trained them to talk more softly. They were just really loud, and that was traumatic for children. So that's one aspect. I'm just thinking now of a few of these things of what we do. I mean, that's a great aspect, that actually having some kind of framework where I'm sure you get clients and you teach them things. What are some of the other ways that you you work with to try, you actually try, the things that you do to bring them back a little bit more into a frame of feeling more securely attached or whatever it is?
Well, one of the things that I have started to do with my clients, those who are aiming to become parents, I actually have introduced to them very easy book, child developmental, you know, books. So right. that, you know, they can learn exactly what are we talking about here. Because unless they see it in writing, you know, in a documented research book, they're not, you know, they just hear some words. But once they read it and they go back and read it, and I, you know, and I ask them to give me reflection so that I know they have read it and they have understood it, and help them to clear out, you know, gray areas for themselves. And then they see themselves among that reading. They said, oh, my God, you know, this is what happened to me. Oh, my God, or this is this didn't happen to me. So they can have a better sense of, you know, what exactly we're talking about in therapy room and what are we talking about in terms of, let's say, attachment, for example. So I think that has become successful. And I like actually when I started doing that. And so that's one of the things that I do. And then Robert.
You know? Well, to me, empathic attunement is one of the big keys, that you can be in the pinpoint of nowness with the person you're working with and reflect to them some of the feelings that you're picking up from them at the level that they're able to take it in. Mm-hmm. And then help them to recognize some of what they got that they didn't need, or that they didn't get that they did need, through that relationship. I think to me that's very important.
Yes, I sometimes share back also some of the feelings I have. I mean, about them, but also about myself. Do you find this sort of? I like it, but it's not necessarily for everybody. But is there is that a useful thing sometimes to for you to be a little bit bare? You know, to be yourself.
You mean self-disclosure?
Absolutely.
Absolutely. Yeah. And of course, depending upon, you know, what is in the best interest of the client, what you believe the client can take in. And sharing. And also showing emotion on my face. I think that's important. Yeah. Which is totally different than the old psychoanalytic blank slate approach.
Yeah, that's an authenticity too.
Yes,
yeah.
Yes.
The disclosure to me needs to be at the level so that the client can feel that we as therapists, we can get their experience, we can connect to them. So it's not about the therapy become about, you know, therapy session become about my issue or my experience, you know. So I have found that to be very powerful.
Yeah.
So the clients look at us as, wow, so this person is not just a book therapy. This person is also talking from real experience in her life, in my case, for example.
Yeah.
So I just give them enough for them to let them know that I understand them and they appreciate that.
There's a saying that I like, and that is that people don't care how much you know until they know how much you care.
Yeah, beautiful.
Yeah.
Well, I know you guys need to run off.
We do.
And I just thank you so much for having
us. Our pleasure. Looking forward to our next meeting.
Next meeting.
Yes, what an absolute pleasure for us. Thank you so much, Mitra and Robin.
Same
thank
here. You. The same
bye-bye.
Here.
Bye-bye. Take care.
Okay. See you guys.
Stay safe.
We will.
Bye-bye.
So that's the sort of conversation that we can have. And I know we've had a couple of these that we probably should have recorded where we've actually focused on one person, or in this case, a couple of people. And we've all just sat around and listened to their expertise. But certainly the mastermind also, we have to and fro's and back and forths and contributions. So we look forward to people joining us each month, first Thursday evening or Friday morning for the Australian audiences, but Thursday evenings and afternoons for Europe and for America. So
yeah, that's right. So I'll put links in the show notes for people to have a look at what's coming up in terms of our mastermind.
Brilliant.
Once again, Richard, thanks. It's been wonderful.
Yeah, I think so. I think excellent. I look forward to the next podcast and the next mastermind, the next magazine. So everything's going well.
Wonderful. Well, thank you, everybody, for joining us here on the Science of Psychotherapy podcast. And as always, we'll catch you next week.
Bye for now.
Thanks for listening to the Science of Psychotherapy podcast. For more great science, go to thescienceofpsychotherapy.com.